Technorama special interview with SF Edwards.
Good morning, folks. This is your captain speaking.
Technorama.
Remember when?
Technorama.
On this day in tech history.
Tech.
And now, the news.
Tech.
What the chuck?
Technorama.
Welcome to Blockhead Video.
Where are the coordinates for the nearest hyperspace jump point?
Over there, in the media corner.
Technorama.
Hold my beer and watch this.
Unfasten your seatbelts to disregard all safety rules. Here your flight crew, Chuck and Craig.
Welcome to Technorama. This is the show that takes a lighthearted look at tech, science, sci-fi, and all things geek. If this is your first time joining us on Technorama, thank you very much for coming along for the ride. If you are a returning listener, you get to ride the ride again for free. We appreciate you giving us your time. I am Chuck Tomasi, and with me as always is Craig Stepp. One of these days, I'm going to run out of snappy little things to say, but until then, it's fun. How are you,
That's
Craig?
Right. I'm okay, but that hyperspace jumping really messes with my stomach.
Did you put on your hyperspace sports bras?
Man, that's what it needed. Yes.
Enough of our silliness. Today we are talking to SF Edwards, author of the new book, On Dagger's Wings. So not to steal too much from the interview itself, let's get right to it. Here we go. Good morning to you, SF. How are you today?
I'm doing okay. I'm getting over surgery, but other than that, I'm good.
Oh, hope everything went all right.
Yeah, still to be determined.
Okay, nothing serious, I hope.
No, I think it was a little more complicated than they intended, so.
Okay, well, best wishes to you. Hope you heal up fast and get back to whatever it is that the surgery enabled you to redo.
Yes.
Or do now. What is it? Is it to enhance yourself? Is that what it is?
No.
No, I mean, like, it can jump higher. That's what I'm talking about. Never mind.
No, I haven't had the bionics installed yet. That's dad. So.
Oh, okay.
There you go. Well, we, like other listeners of Technorama, probably heard your segments on our show and Slice of Sci-Fi. You've been a longtime listener and contributor. And what I did not know until recently is that you are also an author and you have a new book out that we'd like to talk to you about today. So congratulations first. And for those who may not know who you are, give us a little background.
On myself, well, SF Edwards, and as you said, I was a longtime contributor back to Slice, you know, back in the day. Did a couple contributions to you guys. Unfortunately, life got in the way, so I wasn't able to contribute more.
It happens.
I'm an aerospace engineer. I've done flight tests with the Air Force. I've done in-service engineering for the Navy, and now I'm currently working for the FAA doing flight certifications. Beyond that, I have been a pretty active person in the aviation community, sporting community, military community. Never served myself because of medical issues, but a lot of friends throughout, and a lot of that information. What a lot of those people and the information I gleaned from them and that friendships went into my writing as well. So,
and if you tell us any more, you have to kill us.
What's that?
If you tell us any more about the secret job you have, you have to kill us.
That was the biography. A couple friends and I were going to write about somebody we used to work with. unfortunately, a lot of that hasn't been declassified yet, so we're still not able to write it.
So tell us about the new book, On Dagger's Wings.
On Dagger's Wings is the first book of the Spiral Wars series. It's a series I've been developing for quite some time. the overall theme of the series is the main characters are going into a war that's basically been fought on and off, hot, cold, for approximately 200 years. The main character, Blazer Vaunt, his parents were killed during the battle that ended the last armistice when he was pretty young. He's about 5-6 years old at the time. And now he is entering into the academy with a couple of his friends that he enlisted with, that they are entering into the academy to join the special operations program. But first, in this book, focusing primarily on earning their wings and becoming pilots. And just everything that happens from there on in, you know, the people they meet, the conflicts that arise within their team, from outside their team, and not only stuff that's happening at the academy, but things that are happening in the greater war that are affecting them as well.
So this is our character introduction, initial scenario, but you've got more of an arc planned for this, I assume. You said it was a trilogy?
There's actually, it's planned out as 10 books. It originally started out as 7 and it grew out into 10. The first three of which are what I call the Academy cycle, which grew from a single book into 3 books. So that's kind of how things expanded. And that is following them through the Academy, because in the first book, like I said, they're getting their wings. They're learning how to fly. They're coming together as a team before they get thrown into the really, really, really tough stuff. And it's an overall theme that goes throughout the books, that they start out with 2,000 cadets in the freshman class, and people are constantly getting dropped out, washed out, medicaled out, various reasons getting kicked out of the program, to the point where it's a 60% washout rate is the number they're quoted.
So where'd you get the where'd the inspiration for this book come from?
It came from a variety of places. I initially started writing a long, long time ago when I was younger. It was just kind of an outlet I had. And I started out writing a fantasy series, or a fantasy book rather. And I looked at that with some friends and I'm like, hey, you know, I also am really into sci-fi. And I took the idea and I said, well, now it's, you know, the original concept was called Nocturnal Nights. And I said, now this is Nocturnal Nights 2000. Of course, I said this back in the 90s when 2000 sounded super far away.
Yeah, that's right.
Now I just look at him going, what happened to 2000? That was so long ago almost.
Let's make this book 2020. That's only a few years away.
Yeah, and that's basically what happened. And it evolved from there. And as I became more knowledgeable as a person, I became more knowledgeable in science and engineering and in people as well. I'm like, you know, this original concept, there's a good core there, but it's just needing a whole heck of a lot of refinement, which is what I ended up doing for far too many years, was refining it, you know, honing my craft and developing it into a more developed story, into a more developed universe as well. I did a lot of universe building in that time of figuring things out, like, well, in terms of physics, this doesn't make sense. In terms of how people react, this doesn't make sense. In terms of how people speak, that just doesn't work. And then also just seeing what's going on in the rest of the world and in, you know, other science fiction, going, okay, what works, what doesn't. And, you know, a lot of things ended up on the cutting room floor and some things came in. And in a lot of ways, I kind of went back to some of the earlier concepts when I rewrote the book over the various revisions. And said, you know, hey, does it make sense for all these guys to come in together at the very beginning? No, some of these characters have to be introduced later. There has to be more conflict between some of these characters. You know, I mean, I can't just, here's all the characters and let's go. It's like, no, here's your core group and here's these other people that are coming in and leaving and who are having impacts on their lives and on their development and on the story.
I'm curious to know how does your real life job around aerospace fit into the book? I mean, how did that influence the world you built, the technology? Are there attributes that you carried over or did you, what's the word I'm looking for? Look into the crystal ball and see what your, you know, prognosticate what or anticipate what you think is coming.
It definitely did. Because especially when it came to the technology and the tactics and how people reacted to different things and how the universe itself worked. When I first wrote it, when I first started putting this all together, it was very much soft sci-fi, very Star Wars-ish, very, you know, old school sci-fi where it's like, what's physics? You know, I mean, physics were out the window. And as I learned more, I'm like, okay, I got to make sure I get the physics of this right. Not maybe to the point of this is total hard sci-fi, but I need to get it right enough that when somebody reads it, they're like, okay, that makes sense. Especially somebody who knows physics. That was something that one of my early editors and I, we spent a good month and a half on a single chapter, making sure we got the physics right, of similar dynamics and how the way characters are moving and way they're interacting with a spinning space station and things like that. And it really carried over into the designs of the ships, because I design all the ships that go into the books as well, so that they make sense to me. And so I have my descriptions correct, to the point of when I show it to other folks who do ship designs for, who are usually working in another universe. Somebody was like, okay, well, here's my Star Wars design. Here's my Star Trek design. And I'm like, oh, here's my Spiral War design. And they're like, well, why do you have these features? And why do you have that? And why do you have this?
Right.
Because I'm trying to make it as realistic as possible. You know, there's heat dispersion, there's stealth characteristics, there's, oh, here's how it slows down. That was probably one of my favorite scenes in the first season of the original, the new Battlestar Galactica, when they hit the brakes and the reverse thrusters opened on the Viper. And I'm like, oh my God, they finally did it, you know?
Right. You don't just glide into the dock.
Exactly. They're either flipping around and turning around, or there's a reverse thruster that opens. It's like, oh, wow. So I made sure that I incorporated a lot of that into it. And then especially with the other technologies that went into it, and even how the characters are interacting in this military environment, having a lot of friends who were military and working in the military, I got to see how that lifestyle worked and how everybody worked together in that way. Then there were some scenes early in the book that I eventually cut out, because as great as they were for universe building and world building, they didn't move the story. And it was things of, here's somebody getting cut out, here's somebody getting cut immediately, and here's all these like first day things. It's like, they're very interesting world building wise, but they don't move the story. So, you know, something's got cut in that way. And I'm like, you know, I'll use those for something else later.
Right. Now, so I know you said you worked hard at trying to get the physics right and everything. And much like, you know, and when you start talking about that, I think of The Martian, where, you know, everything is feasible, but he took some liberties with a few things. I'm sure you did that as well too, right? To try and move the story along.
Exactly. It's how much, it's one of the things, there's an excellent website that I used as a reference, the Atomic Rockets website, that it's, I respected the science as much as I could and made minimal use of unobtainium or of, you know, plutonium type things. So it says, you know,
Heisenberg compensator.
Exactly. You know, here's the thing that allows this technology to exist, that allows them to travel faster than the speed of light, that allows them to communicate faster than the speed of light, or, you know, that makes sense for having space fighters. You know, I mean, what is that bit of stuff that makes the universe work? And in that way, you know, there's certain sci-fi that does really well with that. Like, you know, the Mass Effect games, it's, you know, here's this stuff that allows you to travel faster than light and have all these powers and have all, you know, this, that, the other thing. I kind of said, okay, I'm doing something similar to that. You know, I use hyperspace, but it isn't Star Wars hyperspace where you can jump in it anywhere. It's point to point hyperspace of, you have to go to certain places, and those places are, you know, those jump points are something you have to control militarily in order to control the systems. Like, you know, you can, it doesn't matter what the space in between planets is, because that's mostly open space and there's just, you know, there's nothing, you know, nobody cares about that. They care about the planets, the space stations, the jump points, you know, the resources. So most battles are fought in a relatively small sphere of influence, with occasional, you know, I'm going to shoot at you from 5 light minutes away and hope that you're still there when the blast gets there.
Right.
So from a standpoint of jump points, it's almost more like a Babylon 5 thing where they're controlled, rather than, hey, I'm just going to randomly set some coordinates and punch the FTL and go there.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
Okay.
And I mean, there's good and bads to both versions of FTL. And that was one of the things that I actually worked on back when I was in college, is I said, okay, you know, here's this theory of hyperspace I have. And I worked with a couple of physics professors to hammer it out and make it as plausible as possible while still being, you know, usable as a device.
Well, tell us more about the characters. I believe your main character is Blazer Vond, Right.
The main character is Blazer Vaughn. That's his nickname is Blazer. His birth name is Shan. He is the main character. He is an orphan. His parent, like I said, were killed when the war reinitiated. He was then later raised by his grandparents before joining into the academy. He joins the academy with three of his friends from the Mappers Guild, which is there's various groups within the main Confederation government. They were in the Mappers Guild. And the Mappers Guild are the guys who map the jump points, maintain the jump buoys, and maintain what's really important, and one of the things they fight over a lot, the jump codes, which tell you where each jump buoy is. Because once you're in hyperspace, there's really the only way you can navigate is to know where you're going and home in on it, like a homing device.
Okay.
So that was where they start out. And there's his best friend, Arian, who he is this, basically think The Rock with a psychology degree.
Interesting.
The Rock with a psychology degree. Sorry. I'm sorry. That was kind of funny.
and that's one of the things that I've always tried to do is like, I have some of these characters that when you first see them, they're the, you know, here's the fighter pilot jock, but who's actually not, you know, he is a fighter pilot, but he's, and while he embrace one of the main characters, Gavitt, he embraces that whole, well, here's the fighter jock, you know, I'm Mr. Fighter jock. Yet when you get past that surface, it's like, no, he's actually a very different person. He's not that stereotype. He just likes to project that because it's easier for him. Then there's one of Blazer's other friends that joins up with him, Bychard, who is an alien who is the only one of his kind. And so he has to deal with the fact that there's a lot of people that don't want him joining the military because he is unique in that he is a possibly mutant, possibly next generation or next evolution of his species. And they're like, you know, we have to preserve you. I have to protect you. But he's like, I'm a free individual. I can make my own choices. There's a woman he meets at the academy named Marta, who is what's called a combat medium, where she is a medic, but at the same time, she can see and speak to basically ghosts, but they're not ghosts. One of the things that goes on in this world is that there's a quantum energy that people project, and it's for lack of a better term, it's a soul that when you die, it disperses or you move on to another plane or it stays behind, and that's what creates ghosts and spirits and these other energies. And Marta, as an individual, is able to actually speak and talk to them, whereas most people just kind of see these spirit orbs that are just annoying things that run around and can relay messages and are used as diagnostic tools, you know, because it's like, here's a sealed box. What's wrong with inside the box? The orb can go in and project an image into the person's mind saying, this is what's in there. And that's what most people get, is these thoughts and impressions and images, whereas she can actually physically communicate, you know, she can communicate with them like they're talking to her.
That's pretty cool.
And then there's a whole other cast of characters. There's a lot of characters are somewhat, they show the roots of the story as starting out as a more of a fantasy tale, whereas there's a main character who is, he's a Lycan. He is a fully transformative Lycan, but due to a mutation, he has no hair.
Okay.
Which creates some interesting visuals later on. His best friend is an elf. Who's like the total joker of the group. He's just the guy who doesn't take anything seriously except for the stuff that he does. And that stuff he takes way too seriously. So he's the guy who's always cracking jokes and, you know, all that kind of thing. Then there's the actual leader of their team who is she's a veteran. They're all veterans. They all have to do 3 years of service enlisted before they can join the academy. That's just a hard and fast rule. But she's like, you know, a senior veteran. She's like had 10 years in as a chief. And now she's coming down and she's leading the group. But at the same time, she's mentoring Blazer and one of these other characters, Zythe, to take over for her as the team leader because she wants to be the squadron leader. So there's a lot going on in that way. And at the same time, then there's an enemy character who is not someone who interacts with the characters too much, but he is basically an intelligence officer trying to find them. He's trying to find the academy to basically as a career progression. He's kind of stuck where he is in his career on the enemy side. And he's like, if I can find this academy and I can destroy this academy, boom, I'm there. I'll be an admiral. I'll be, you know, the top dog. So he's working on finding them and then wants to, you know, lead a battle to destroy them. Because finding and destroying an academy full of cadet officers in training would be a huge coup.
So these are the main two warring factions are, I'm pulling this straight out of the book bio, the Universal Confederation of Sentient Beings and the Galactic mm-hmm. Federation. And Blazer and his crew are on the side of the Confederation of Sentient Beings, correct?
That is correct.
Okay. And what are the main divisions between who's in the Confederation and who's in the Galactic Federation? And tell us about the viewpoints there.
The biggest differences are the Confederation has been around longer. At this point of the books, it's been around for about 1,000 years. It was formed by 7 initial races who came together for a common goal, a common purpose. There was another alien race that was basically trying to come in and wipe everybody out. They came together and the government grew and grew from there. And they're very much they're a true confederation where it is. The confederation itself basically provides jump codes to its member races, military defense, trade defense, the very basics of, you know, the government, and everybody else is basically free to govern the way they see fit. So long as they don't like violate sentient rights, you know, they're not allowed to keep slaves. They're not allowed to make war with each other without, you know, whereas the Galactic Federation and part of the thing is also they're pretty much set in the Sagittarius, what we call the Sagittarius arm of the Milky Way. The Galactic Federation is based out of the Orion spur of the Milky Way. Their group is more totalitarian. It has a very strong central government that says, no, if you don't do what we say, we're going to beat you down and you're going to basically become a, for lack of a better term, a slave race. Mm-hmm. You know, you can eventually earn freeman status by working your way up, but your world is a subjugated world. And this goes against, you know, some of the main Confederation tenets. Mm-hmm. And then there's also an issue of that there are some older races behind the scenes that are kind of pulling some strings and are maybe not giving everybody the whole truth of what's going on and are they want the conflict to continue. The conflict begins in the book as it was revised included an extended prologue that I wrote that follows the beginning of the conflict and the whole thing that the conflict began really by mistake. A Galactic Federation ship entered Confederation territory. A Confederation patrol spotted them, came in and said, hey, you know, made first contact, but it was a fighter patrol because they were just out on their patrol. They weren't expecting anybody to come in. The fighter patrol was destroyed and, you know, it was 3 fighters against a capital ship and they were destroyed pretty readily.
Hope we're not giving away any spoilers.
I'm trying not to. Okay. Because this is basically how the book opens. So there was a retaliatory strike. The ship was destroyed, and then they opened up diplomatic. They tried to open diplomatic relations, and things just went downhill from there. The Galactic Federation basically wanting territory, wanting technology, not wanting to coexist with this. Not really pacifistic confederation, but this confederation that said, hey, you can do your own thing, but you can't keep slaves. There are certain things you're not allowed to do that you are forcing on others that we can't allow that. And the confederation would be fine with just letting them do their thing, but the Galactic Federation keeps attacking them. So it's like, okay, we have to fight back.
So what are some of the things that you've taken influence from to bring like this story? Like what are some of the, I guess I should say, what are some of the books that you've read that feed into your stories that kind of give you inspiration?
You know, that's I've drawn inspiration from so many different sources because, I mean, there are so many different sources to draw from. I was raised on classic sci-fi and, you know, more modern sci-fi as well. there is a fair amount of Heinlein in there. There is a fair amount of Zahn in there. Some Stackpole, Asimov. It's really, I think of all the things that I have drawn from, of like, you know, the fact that I'm dealing with a lot of these more ancient races that are somewhat Lovecraftian in the way that they are portrayed. You know, these are some very ancient beings that these characters will encounter, that it's just like, they don't care. They're just, okay, whatever, you're ants to us. We're just going to, you leave us alone, we'll leave you alone, kind of thing. The political aspect that goes on, of even the infighting, that I make it pretty clear in there that, you know, even within the Confederation, not everybody is all hugs and kisses. It's, there are races in the group that they just don't like each other for whatever reason, you know. Maybe it's how they got into space, or maybe it's just other ideological differences. And some, even within their own species, that have, or within their own race, that have issues with each other. One of the characters, Gawkhead, he's what's called a Drashig. He's, and their species, there's the cliff dwellers and the plains dwellers, and they don't like each other. It's an ideological difference that's always kind of divided their society. So I wanted to make sure that, unlike certain other sci-fi, and in a lot of sci-fis, it's like, you know, hey, I like that idea, but I don't like certain other things that go on. It's like, with too many sci-fis, it's, this is the warrior race, this is the Roman race, this is the, you know, this is the people of high thinkers, and...
Star Trek's probably a good example of that, what you're just...
I was trying not to say it, but yeah, there it is. You know,
I'll say it. No.
Here's the greedy race, you know. It's
right.
I tried to make it clear that it's like, you know, all these races are, while they might have a common theme amongst them, you know, common, like a major religion that unites the group, or a major philosophy that unites the group, there are still individuals that are like, no, we don't agree with that, you know. Most of the characters in this are Anulian, which is a very humanoid race, but there are physiological differences between Anulians and what Earth humans, though they're visually, very visually similar. But even though this group is primarily Anulian, they're from all different points on that planet, and there are ideological differences even on that planet that they kind of run into with each other. There's a character, she's a Chamalad, who is Anulian, yet she has the ability to change the color of her skin to kind of blend in. It was a mutation that was specific to a certain region in a certain group, and because they do that as hunters, they tend to not wear much in the way of clothing.
Woohoo!
So, yes.
hey, so I was curious. Now you have my attention.
And there are a couple of scenes in the book that deal with that, and how this one female character, Chris, how the male characters are like, she's really skirting the edge of the
dress code
uniform rules there.
Right.
And that's part of her personality, is she really likes to push those boundaries. And, you know, with the story being primarily told through an over the shoulder of Blazer, you know, when his first interaction with her in the book is just like, hi, how you doing? Let's go for that jog. Yes.
Let's go for that jog. Hey, I got a trampoline out back.
Yeah. You know, at the same time, he's trying to be respectful of her heritage and everything. He's just like, okay, this is a woman who is on my team. Don't stare. Don't stare. Oh my God. Don't stare.
You know,
as you know, as a 21-year-old guy, I'm like, okay, you know, as the character is a 21-year-old guy, it's like, I'm at the same time trying to make it pretty realistic that it's like, yeah, he's gonna look. He's trying not to, but he's gonna look. Unlike, let's say, an adaptation of one of my favorite Heinlein books that had everybody in a shower together and nobody acted like it was a big deal.
So what other genres do you enjoy reading, and how have they influenced your work?
I've always enjoyed horror, and I've read a lot of horror. You know, there's the debate of who's the better horror writer, King or Kuntz, and I've always kind of followed under the Kuntz flag.
Okay.
And I enjoy a lot of the way he writes. I read a lot of Lovecraft growing up. I still read Lovecraft on occasion. So I think a lot of that kind of influences because I try and get in that when these characters are dealing with things that are just, they're beyond them. You know, it's this doesn't make any sense to a human being who's lived in this three-dimensional world and suddenly I'm in hyperspace and everything is different. The rules don't make any sense, that people can go loopy. And there is dealing with characters and aliens that we would see as monsters that may not be. And it's kind of throwing those tropes and ideas on their heads. I also, you know, I enjoy, you know, action adventures, and I wanted to make the book very much an adventure as well. I used to love reading mysteries, and unfortunately, most mysteries now I just find too. I have a hard time reading most modern mysteries because I figure them out in the first 10 pages.
It's like my wife; she's watching TV and she goes, "Oh, he did it," she's even gotten to the point where she'll throw out the lines, and about a moment later, the character says the same line. I'm like,
Donna and I do that all the time. It's a contest now.
Yeah. And that's one of the things that it's like, you know, somebody said, well, you love mysteries so much. Why don't you write mysteries? I'm like, because I can't write them. It's like, as soon as I write it and if I'm trying to be too mysterious and trying to cover things up too much, I end up revealing it. You know, I think mysteries are a very hard genre to write and actually keep, you know, where you're leaving enough clues that you can eventually at the end say, oh, okay, I could see it now, but not give it away early on.
Right.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
And I do hate in certain genres when they're like, oh, let's throw this mysterious thing in there for absolutely no reason. And it's like, why do that? You know, it doesn't really add anything to the story. It doesn't add anything to the characters. It's just you're being mysterious for the sake of being mysterious.
Right.
And it doesn't add anything. And not to say that I don't do some of that where there are mysteries that are going on. You know, there are things that are going on behind the scenes that these characters, as the story begins, they don't know. You know, they don't know why certain things are the way they are. And they're trying to discover these things. Clues come in over the course of everything that's going on to reveal these things to them. And some of it is, you know, some of it eventually becomes critical to what's going on in the war effort and in their lives. And other things are just, it's world building, you know?
Yep. Absolutely.
And there's that fine line when it comes to writing of how much do you give to the story and how much do you give to building the world. And that was one of the things that I definitely had to learn as I was writing this. In that the earlier versions probably spent a good 100+ pages before they ever got to the Academy. And I said, you know, this is a lot of great universe building and world building, but it doesn't move the story. So a lot of it ended up being cut.
Well, you can always release that as, you know, a companion book or something. Kind of like, J.K. Rowling did with the Harry Potter things. There's an entire book on Quidditch to give backstory to that.
And that's one of the things that I've really doing is that I've taken some of those things and said, okay, I've taken this chapter that was about them playing this game. It's a game called Slam Ball that they do play in the book. And instead of throwing it there at the very first chapter, now it's 5-6 chapters in. And it's from a very different perspective than it was before. So I included it because it is a great piece of world building and character building at the same time. I want to make sure that it was character building and plot moving at the same time as being this, you know, this world building thing.
Well, you can always come out with the Slam Ball Sports Almanac.
Exactly. Exactly. I could do that. And one of the things that one of the readers, the beta readers who have read it before have said is they like that I don't just, I mean, because let's face it, when we read Harry Potter and they first described Quidditch, the first thing he does is, here's the rules, here's how you score points. You know, it's this very, if it wasn't written in such a good way, it would be very dry, here's how the game was played. Whereas I just say, here's the game, here they're playing, oh, they scored this way, they got this many points. Here's, you know, it's not so much here's the rules, it's here's how the referee is ruling. In order for you to say, okay, so there you get enough of the mechanics without sitting there getting bogged down in it. Even one of the compliments I received from my editor, one of the beta readers, was later in the book, I describe how hyperspace works. And it's not some dry, here's how it is. It's two of the characters talking about it.
Right.
Basically, the main character of Blazer is he's fixing a ship. And Marta is there helping him with his homework and says, okay, here's this question on your homework. Explain how explain hyperspace theory. And he's just like, what?
Yeah. In three sentences. Like,
yeah, exactly. He's just like, what do they mean? Explain hyperspace theory. Do they want the math? Do they want this? And then he goes into explaining it while he's doing this work. So there's interjections in there of, you know, him banging his head and getting equipment and that kind of thing to try and liven it up. And that's one of the things I also try and do in general with all of the science is I try not to bog down the story by, like certain writers do of explaining the rotational velocity of the space station and explaining, oh, well, this is why, you know, this is how much gravity there must be in here. It's just, it's a spinning space station. They're at this much gravity. Go with it.
Right. So what you've just laid out there, we've been talking about is good advice for other writers as well. So what would you have for advice for any writers that are just starting out that maybe need to take some of this into account or maybe do research or whatnot? What kind of advice would you give them?
I would definitely say don't be afraid to do your research on whatever subject matter you're writing about. If you're not an expert on it, become an armchair expert at the least. When you are writing, go ahead and put it all down on paper. Go ahead or put it all into the computer, however your form is. I will say one of the early chapters that I cut out was their approach to the academy, and it was all the math. It was the character figuring it all out and saying, well, it's spinning at this rate. It looks about this diameter, so it must be producing this much gravity. But wait, that's way too high. And oh, wait, because it's a rocky, it's carved out of an asteroid. It must be so thick in order to get. And it's like, it's great if you're doing straight up hard sci-fi, but you lose readers who aren't really interested in that. And if you have that, it's like, okay, great. That's great information to have. Pull it out and put it in supplemental material.
Right.
Don't be afraid to make cuts of stuff that doesn't move the story along. You can always put it somewhere else. You can always introduce it in some other way. There was some word I saw to this. It was a long time ago. It was in terms of how you publish now. It's like you're not just publishing unless you're writing just a straight literature story or a straight, you know, regular detective mystery or horror story, you can write in such a way that all of that supplemental material, you can put on a website. You can put it out there for people to do. Like one of the things that I have done is I have all these technical files, dossiers on the characters, technical files on ships, how the communication systems works. You know, build all that back universe, give hints in the books, in the story of how it works, just enough to convince the readers that it works. And then do all the hard math and all the hard science and stuff elsewhere, because people will tear it apart if it's wrong in the book. If it's in the supplemental material, they'll be more willing to sit there and say, well, you know, you got this math wrong here, and they'll be willing to work with you more. You know, it's kind of like the Ringworld example of people wrote Niven thousands of letters telling him he got the math wrong. So in the next vision, he fixed the math. And it's like, you know, that's great and all, but at the same time, it's like, had he written that in today's environment, you know, he would have had a Ringworld website to go along with it that explained all the math instead of having the characters explain all the math. So it's allow the story to move along, remove the stuff that doesn't, but keep it as supplemental material. Don't throw anything away. Just keep it in your back pocket.
Good advice. Good advice. You know, after talking to you, I'm very interested in reading about this. So tell the listener where they can find you, your books, and all that goodness.
All right. The book is being released through Space Dock Press out of England. It will be available on Kindle and all, I believe, e-publishing platforms on the 27th, to be followed shortly thereafter by on Amazon, at least, in hardback. And we are and it should be getting distributed as well to local bookstores, but I'm the author. They don't tell me all that.
Right.
The SpiralWar.com website should be up shortly, but if you go to spacedoc.com /SF Edwards or SF-Edwards, that is my author page, and that will direct you to things from there. And I will also be posting things to the Space Doc forums to communicate to folks on what's going on with the books and where I'm putting things, especially in regards to the technical files as I build up the website, as we build up the website more and get all that supplemental material out there.
Outstanding. Craig, any closing comments?
I like space.
I love space. Elon, get to Mars.
I like aliens and wars, so we're all set. Thank you very much. It's been a lot of fun today.
All right, thank you.
And we look forward to talking. Let us know when the next book's coming out. We'll do more pimping and promoing for you.
Actually, books 2 and 3 should actually be releasing this year because I've actually written all the way through book 4 and I'm working on book 5 as we speak.
Oh,
got
wow.
A pipeline.
Yes, I've got a lot written already, and I've actually got the whole arc, the whole series plotted out.
Wow. And he did all that over his Christmas vacation. That's awesome.
I wish. No.
Right. Well, congratulations again. We look forward to hearing more about it. We'll send you a link when everything's all up and posted. Should only be a few days.
All right. Sounds good.
Thanks.
All right. Appreciate it. Thank you. Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Thank you again, SF, for your time today. We wish you all the best of luck on your new book and the whole series. We look forward to talking to you in the future. Thank you to our Patreon members for making this show and specials like this interview possible. If you are interested in supporting the show, visit our Patreon site at patreon.com/technoramapodcast. If you have comments about today's show, get a hold of us on the listener line, 707-530-2428. We would love to hear from you. 707, I get it. The flight line thing, SF Edwards 707.
I got it.
Okay. 530, which means nothing to me. And the 2428, that spells chat. So with that terrible mnemonic, I'm sure you can give us a call.
It's time for your bedtime, isn't it?
Apparently so. You can find out more information on our website at chuckchat.com/technorama. For interviews, our regular show, which we do on Facebook on Sunday nights. We release that into the podcast feed on Tuesday nights. We just have a whole calendar full of fun. In fact, you can subscribe to our calendar. It's a calendar full of fun. I forgot about that on Google Calendar.
Every day.
As always, tell a friend about Technorama, and Craig, do that binary high five, but do it like in a flight line way.
Flight line?
You're clear for 101.
Clear to take off on runway 101, which is totally bogus. There is no 3-digit runway.
I know, right?
All right, take care. Thanks.